What's happening in the canine industry? For all the latest news, views, and expert opinions, stay right here for the Canine Paradigm. You'll hear from industry leaders, experts, doyens of the industry, learned colleagues, movers and shakers, and the odd randy guest. Get the latest insights and expert advice from both here and abroad from the people in the know. Now, here are your hosts, Glenn Cook and Pat Stewart. And I'm Lofty Fulton, and I'm out of here.
It's been so long since we've put a new
We're shit house at it. We're so bad at it.
It's, our poor sponsors.
We're so bad at it, and we want to get better going forward.
Yes.
But here's a quick ad, and then we're going to be better at this.
Okay.
We're going to be better.
Yeah.
I promise we're going to be better.
Yeah. Except for the Buffhead.
Yeah. Fucking Einzelwina.
Tell us about Einzelwina.
He's been in it from the start. If you want a tug, a ball, a slip leash.
A slip lead.
You know, really, no joke, his slip leads are the best slip leads.
They are great slip leads.
They are the best.
But they're handmade. They're hand loved.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's times where I look at material when we're actually buying things for our businesses and some of them are just shit house.
Yeah.
Like they're so mass produced. Jason takes his time. He puts them together properly.
Like if you're listening, chances are you're in the industry, you're in the business, you need a lot of leashes, you sell them to clients, blah, blah, blah.
Yep. Just
deck out your staff. The best thing about the Einzelwina leashes is that he custom makes them.
He does.
You can get whatever you want, whatever color, whatever length.
Too. Like he's approachable.
Want a handle on it, no handle on it, whatever. I had him make that handler pack for me because I got sick of people turning out with shit leashes. Now everyone I train with uses all these perfect leashes.
Yep.
So get some stuff from the Einzelwina. He's been supporting us from the start. We love him. We hate him sometimes.
Make sure you're telling me he's a bullfed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Canineceuticals.
Going great. Thank you, people in the United States who prioritize your dog's health through supplementation.
I am a walking testimonial for Canineceuticals because if you go back, you were here 18 months ago. I was like, yeah, pretty sure my dog's going to die any minute because he was so unwell and got him on the sups and he's actually in the best shape he's been in ages.
Narelle's always maintained if it never worked, she'd burn it to the ground. She's just got too much pride and too much neuroticism not to put something to market that she didn't believe in. And the wonderful thing about it is it's working well. The testimonials have been amazing and very heartfelt. Like she gets people who are so agitated and depressed and distressed about the health and the well-being of their dogs. Narelle makes no outrageous claims. Mm-hmm. She's never said that it's the one thing that does everything for dogs. She just says it's going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
By law, she's not allowed to make those claims, but she wouldn't want to anyway. But what she does tell people is it's definitely going to do better for your dog.
Yeah.
We watch our own dogs. Opie, who's got more things than you could poke a stick wrong with him, he probably wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't through Narelle's treatment, through good supplementation, changing diets, all those sort of things. I could talk about it forever. I don't want to make this sound like a buyer sales pitch. I'm a fan of it because I know if it works. If it didn't, I wouldn't.
Well, it's an ad.
Well, it's an ad.
But I wouldn't disgrace myself by talking about something that didn't work. I'd be the same with her. I'd just say burn it to the ground. I don't want to know about it.
Yeah.
And if you're a first-time customer in Australia or the US, Narelle's offering a 10% discount off the entire range of Canineceuticals products by typing in the discount code TCP10 at checkout.
Let's work through our sponsored list.
Yes.
These are the people that sponsor us and we love them for it and we're plugging their business.
Yes.
First on our list here is Daniel, who we don't know how to say is Tropiano? Tropino.
I thought we just called him Troppy Daniel.
Troppy Daniel. Dog Club, South Australia.
Yep.
Awesome training facility.
Representing South Australia. It is great to see that a state that's usually sleepy and not considered.
Just hosting some cool events there.
Yeah. Yeah, good on you, Daniel. Well done.
George Kittredge.
Rowdy Hound.
Yeah. It's fucking cool. It's a box for your dog that goes on your motorbike.
The only one that I know of.
Yeah. It's the coolest product
ever. Not in Australia yet. So hopefully one day we can talk to Horny George about getting some Rowdy Hound dog boxes in here. He does training videos. He shows people how to train their dogs to get into the Rowdy Hound. He's a dog trainer himself. He's in the biz.
Yep. Barbara de Groot.
From the Heart Dog Training.
That's her.
Our sugar mama.
Yeah.
She's so good.
I love
her. She asks nothing in return. She just plusses with love and money. She's very encouraging all the time. Thank you, Barbara. She's a Roddy lady. So what would you expect?
Yep. Tailored Canines.
We don't know much about Tailored Canines. They just turned up one day and said, hey, we just want to throw some money at you. But they offer a complete range of canine training services.
Yep. Tailored Canines. Where are they? They're in Canada, right?
They're in Canada.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple of Canadians, we've got a couple of Americans, we've got a couple of Aussies, good eclectic mix. We haven't got anyone from Europe. Fucking hell. Up your game.
But we can't take any more sponsors. So We're bad enough at Birdie. Oh, yeah. So we are plugging as well. Birdie was on for us last week and then told us about her webinar thing that she's got going on for people in the
Magic of Dogs.
Magic of Dogs. So head to birdieoshetty.com, I think is her website, and you can check that out there. All the sponsors, trust us, we're getting better at the ads. I promise you, next we're going to be in touch with you and we're going to get better at it. We're going to take it more seriously. We're just shit at it because we've got other stuff and this is just an extra that we like to do. We thank you very much
for
your support.
But we both spanked each other. Pat spanked me and then I spanked him. And
we need to get better at this.
Yeah, we do.
We were going to leave it another week of the existing ad and thought, no, we can't possibly. We're actually together for the first time. Yep. That's what's been holding us back is that we
haven't been together.
Yeah. I missed you.
I missed you too.
All right, that's it. Here's the show.
Bye.
Welcome back to the Canine Paradigm. I'm your host, Pat Stewart. I'm joined in studio by my co-host, Glenn Cook.
Hello, sir.
We're back.
Finally, after. I don't want to make this into the sick podcast.
The dog two training guys with show. The plague.
Oh, man. It's amazing how that bloody virus, whatever I got and you got subsequently, we actually have missed a full episode because of how sick both of us had been. But after the last one I did, I thought, I'm getting better. I woke up Saturday morning and I progressed through the day and I felt like, no, I'm actually not. I'm getting worse. And I was sitting on the couch on Sunday. I was actually trying to feed myself. I was having soup for lunch and I was trying to feed myself and I literally had no energy to get the spoon from the bowl to my mouth. I said, Narelle, something's very wrong. I said, I feel like all my life energy is fading out of my body. So she went into her office, she came out and she put this little thing on my finger that measures your blood oxygen.
Yeah.
And it should be about 95, 96 for healthy people.
Yeah.
At one stage, it was 85.
Wow.
So she went and rang the nurse online and said, hey, this has happened to my husband. I'm thinking we should go to hospital. She goes, you either take him to hospital now or I can call an ambulance for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So Narelle's gone, okay, get your shit. We're going to hospital. So I end up in hospital and, I was like on a drip and within minutes of being there. And it was pretty gnarly, man. Like that hasn't happened to me. Even when I've had COVID and all sorts of shit, that shit hasn't happened to me. But you now know how I felt because then you went downhill quickly and are still subsequently quite unwell.
Yeah, I was really, really sick. I had to cancel stuff. Like usually I just kind of, fuck, I can do this, right? But I couldn't even do a live stream. So like it's not like I canceled going and hanging out with people. Even the idea of turning on my computer, it was impossible.
That's the thing. Like people have got no idea, and that's what I'm trying to express to them is – it felt like my life energy had just depleted straight from my body. I even read online recently that Bill Church is actually in hospital with pneumonia.
I saw that,
I was speaking to my own GP and he said, look, there's some terrible amounts of bacterial pneumonia going through Sydney at the moment. He said, like, healthy, fit, young people have come up with cases of bacterial pneumonia.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's what I had. I certainly had a chest infection of some degree.
Yeah.
I'm still on a steroid inhaler and, you know, like I've been on antibiotics literally since I left hospital, but it's been a hell of a ride and I don't wish it on anybody. It's been absolutely terrible. I've been so sick with it. And even for you to have time off, you must be pretty sick with it as well.
Yeah, man, it fucked me up. I'm still sort of recovering. But anyway, we're
back.
We're here. We're doing it.
People will be listening to this in a year's time or so forth and going, what the fuck went on?
Shut up, you losers. Shut up, you man fluers.
You whingy old men sitting there.
We don't want to hear about how sick you are. Shut the fuck up. Anyway, we're here.
Doing it. We've had a request in that time to talk about switching drives in dog training.
Mm.
We generally tend to medley that into things that we're talking about anyway, but it is a good topic nonetheless because if I recall and I think back onto the very first times that I really started getting involved back in those early ADT times with Boyd and there was a guy there, Dave Schmicke, he was really the person that influenced me in the early days. He lives in Thailand or something like that now and his colleague listens to the show and actually played it to Dave last time I was talking about his dog, Staga.
Yeah.
Right. I haven't seen Dave for like 25 years. It's incredible the reach that this actually has. So, yeah, it was Dave Schmicke. I was sitting down the back and he was talking to me when I first got there because I was a client. I wasn't there to train as a trainer. I was there to train Harley when he was a young puppy.
And subsequently, Dave got me down the back and he goes, mate, if you're going to understand, if you really want to understand this, because I was talking about wanting to become a trainer at that time. I was really bitten by the bug. I was really enthusiastic and I was what you call a hang around at that stage. Mm-hmm. So I was one of those people that was in between becoming a client into it being very interested in the training side of things. Mm-hmm. So I'd sit there and listen to the trainers talk and Dave came over to me and he said, mate, like if you're going to get serious about this, you really need to have a clear understanding of dog switching drives. In particular, then he was talking about switching between defense drive into predatory drive.
Yeah.
Because that was an important part of our role. It was because first and foremost, we were agitating the dogs to show a civil response. And when we got that, we were rewarding the dog for showing like a very serious side by going into prey. And then saying to the dog, I want you to feel this. I want you to experience this emotion. I want you to express it to me as much as you possibly can by visually indicating lots of teeth and the dog attempting to come forward and do damage. Mm. And then when you do that, the arm would generally be produced behind the back because in those days it was more sleeves than it was suits like it is these days for particularly a lot of sports, then the arm would be produced and then you'd go into a total prey mode to reward the dog. Subsequently, the dog would then get the bite. That was always fascinating to me to watch a dog switch between two fundamentals of a mind frame. Mm. In one instance, you could see the dog like, I'm very serious. The dog might have been on a back tie or the dog might have been with the handler at that point in time. The decoy would then come up. They might not even have the sleeve. They might have had the sleeve on the ground behind them, depending on the dog's capability. If the dog was able to get it out of its head that there was a sleeve on the ground, sometimes you can't do that. Like for people who don't understand this, sometimes the presence of the sleeve and the equipment on the ground for an equipment-focused and heavily prey-orientated dog, they will be fixated by that sleeve and they can't switch into the required defense mode. Some people might be saying to me or listening to this and thinking along to themselves, why would you want to do that? What's the purpose behind that? So the purpose behind that for us in those days is we were fundamentally focusing on a protection style of dog. Mm-hmm. We weren't training a sporting type of dog. We weren't training a dog where we did definitely want to orientate them to sleeve. However, when you've got sports such as PSA, PSA does like to show an expression of a defense drive in the carjacking scenario. Mm-hmm. They want to show the true power and the expression of the dog. And the dog is rewarded by a hidden sleeve being produced and the dog being allowed to bite, which the dog knows this is the reward for showing this type of behavior. But back then, that was the game. The game was if you're working on the street or if somebody comes up in a hostile manner, first and foremost, we want you to show a defensive posture. We want you to really come forward and show that person, I'm not here to fuck spiders. This is a legit frontage. Like proceed past this at your folly.
It's a funny one. I want to get around to eventually sort of defining drives because I think that for a lot of our listeners, that probably is worthwhile. But
yeah.
To your point there with protection dogs, like actual dogs that, you know, like someone would have with them in order to scare people away. Mm. That defensive drive is so important because a lot of the prey type dogs, they're not very intimidating. And so, you know, I had and raised and sold a dog once that was truly what you would call like a prey monster in that he's, you know, that term gets thrown around a fair bit, but I believe that dog would have died in prey. Like he just didn't really see anything as a threat and he was so strong in his prey drive. But as a result, he was a very dangerous dog because he wasn't intimidating at all. He didn't appear angry ever. He was in a really appetitive state and the more pressure that anybody put on him and the more like overt the threat, the happier he got and he was loose in his body. There was nothing that would tell you that dog was going to bite you because he was so happy and excited at the prospect of getting to bite someone that he was like, oh, this is wonderful. This is going to go great for me. And as a result, ended up being much too dangerous to go into the service for the people that we provided him to because he didn't scare anyone away. He didn't look like a dangerous dog even in the slightest. And so he'd just bite without any of the precursors. It was all prey. So anyway, sorry.
That's a really important point and it validates exactly what I'm talking about and the reason that we wanted to do this is because we did want the dog to visually indicate, I am showing you a true form of aggression. Mm. For a lot of people who have been involved in this for periods of time or have a knowledge of how defense drive works and how it can be on the borderline of avoidance sometimes,
if you know how to do this well, you can get the dog past that.
Yeah.
Like you can develop a confidence in the dog where the dog understands. It's primarily pre-macked. So the dog is taught you have to do this. Like you may not like it at the start and it may not be totally desirable, but it's part of the game.
Mm.
Like the game consists of you have to show like a genuine hideous face with plenty of clout, like seriousness that I'm going to come forward and fuck you up if you proceed past this point. And then as a result of that, to reward the dog, as we say, we always produce some form of enjoyment for the dog to dial it down. So the dog goes, there's a reason for this. There's benefit in doing this.
Mm.
And it's like everything that we start off very light, allow the dog to show the most minuscule expression of defense. And then we reward straight in prey straight away.
Yeah.
But then we build on it and we say, well, now I've seen that you're capable of giving a little bit. I want a little bit more. I'm not going to push you over the stress threshold, but I certainly am going to take you to the limitation of it. And then when I can see that you're at that, you know, like a talented trainer will know that. They'll know that you're at the peak of that stress threshold. They'll say, fantastic. Here comes the prey reward for you.
Yeah.
And you will build and build and build. And that becomes a molehill into a mountain in no time at all. If you're patient and if you do it correctly and you work along the aptitude of the dog, whatever the dog's allowing you to do. But you're 100% right. Like there are dogs out there. I remember an Akita that came down for training one day.
Mm-hmm.
And this Akita was so stoic in the way that it presented itself. It just sat there and it almost looked like a taxidermy dog.
Mm.
It would sit there and the only thing for the learned eye that you would know that that dog was about to strike is it would raise itself on its front paws.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't see that, you would miss the point entirely and it could be exceptionally dangerous to try and decoy that dog because it didn't turn its head, it didn't puff its chest, it didn't raise its ears. You couldn't see hackles on the dog because they've got a coat like that anyway. There was no change in the tail because it was just a big curly ball at the end of the dog anyway. The only thing that gave it away was that dog would go from flat on its paws to raised on its paws, which meant
anticipation of a strike, right?
Anticipation of strike. It's like watching a snake coil. Mm. Like if you don't know what you're seeing sometimes, you can't really see that the snake is articulating its body to move up in line with its head so it can keep its head focused on what it was doing. And that's exactly what this fucking dog did.
Mm.
And it was incredible to see. Like for me, learning and coming up as an apprentice and watching that application is incredible, absolutely incredible. But representing similar scene that you were talking about before with the dog that you were talking about where they're so confident in themselves or that they don't understand this is what I'm supposed to do. Like, I don't understand this. And for some of those dogs, you could do terrible things to them and they go, well, I just don't get it. I don't get why you're doing this. Like, just let me get to the end of it. Like, eventually you can find something, but some of these dogs are, as I said, they're so resistant to it that they just think, I just want to call you in. I don't want to frighten you away. Mm. I don't want you to run away. I don't want you to do all this crisscrossing where other dogs would love it. Like they show you a bit of defense work. You'd run across and play the game and start developing the little pantomime that the dog needs. And then eventually you'd swing the arm out and bang, the dog would get rewarded. And they think, perfect. So you could see a very clear, and this is when I'm getting back to when I was doing that lesson with Dave, he would show me in those early days when I was in that cusp of becoming a customer to a trainer, what it actually looked like. And I didn't understand it. Like I knew what it was in theory, but when I actually got to see a dog do it, a dog that did it well, I thought to myself, I can clearly see what it is now.
Yeah.
Like I understand what switching drives means to get a dog into thinking and feeling a certain way. And then transposing that into a different architecture of brain type.
Mm-hmm.
So having a dog being threatened and feel like, yep, I'm going to meet this with aggression, but then go into a completely different mindset where the eyes, the shape of the eyes changed, the ear set of the dog changed, the body posture of the dog changed from I'm going to get into a fight with you to, oh, here comes something that I really want. And you could see it in the dog, like the expression that the dog shifted and changed just happened to be a very expressive dog that you could learn from it very well. But even as time went on and different dogs presented themselves who were more or less likely to exhibit those, like that Akita is an extreme case, but even other dogs in between that, like it was fascinating to watch what are your triggers? What does it take to get you to feel this way in a defensive state as opposed to feeling this way in a very predatory-minded state?
Yeah, I think that serves us perfectly as an intro to discuss that in the protection realm, whether it's sports or real or whatever, drive channeling, we call it, is a very well-known thing. And we bounce between prey and defense, and we have to. And so for us in the work that we do there, that is week one, day one type stuff, is that you have to understand what drive is this dog in. I think to pick up this template and put it over the question that we're asked to talk about, because it was specifically relating to play drive, right? The question that we were asked to discuss.
Let me read the question. So this comes from Mushu the Foster. And it says, I would love to have Pat and Glenn do an episode on ways to achieve satiation for dogs through play. What type of interaction, in brackets games, work well for enforcing desired behavior versus undesired behavior? Do certain breeds need certain types of play, fetch, tug, search, etc., to be mentally fulfilled? How can humans teach the dogs to switch between drives? Meaning, for example, the dog is in prey drive during play, and now the human wants to end the game and have the dog decompress and switch to pack drive. Thank you. Love the show.
Okay. What you've said about the switching between prey and defense, super important to us in the bite work.
Absolutely.
It's week one, day one type stuff. And when you're working a dog, you want to know what drive are we looking to work within. And then we eventually get to drive switching and drive capping. Okay. Mm-hmm. So for us, we use the terms drive channeling because we want to bring the dog into a particular drive and keep it there. Then we want to be able to switch the dogs in drives and bring them from one drive to another. And then when we have that, we also then want to be able to drive cap, where we like basically shake up the Coke bottle, right? Mm. Because we want to coil that up, and we need dogs to be able to hold positions. And, you know, like what we want is that while a dog is being agitated, it doesn't act. It can stay, but we can't stop it feeling the emotions that it feels. But what through drive capping we do is we get it to display a different behavior to what Mother Nature tells it it should display during the presentation of the stimulus of the drive.
It almost sounds a little bit like you're talking about suppression.
A little bit, Liam. So I think noting that that's a normal thing in the protection world, it's not as well known and it's not as well explored in the pet dog type space, but it's just as important. But we're maybe going to play in different other drives.
Well, more in the pet dog space where drive suppression actually does come into play.
Totally.
Quite a lot because of things like play drive, where it becomes excessive and exuberant. And then people are saying, well, this is too much. The dog is now bowling my kids over. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't have visitors come inside the house and have the dog interact at the same time because the dog can't switch out of this drive.
So let's first just describe actually what a drive is. Mm. For my money, I call the drives that dogs will express as the inherent desires within the dog, right? So I think that they don't need to learn anything about these drives. You can get them to cultivate it, like we say. You can get them to suppress it. You can get them to express it. You can play with these drives. You can move them around, but they're the inherent desires of the dog. A long time ago, I looked into the literature of drives, you know, like, okay, let's have a look and see what papers are actually written about this. And I got lost in it. This was years and years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I decided, okay, because when I was like, okay, what do people mean when they say drives, right? Mm. So I started looking for that, and it was just a bit overwhelming. And I remember finding one thing, I think it was from like a German police dog study, saying that there were 17 different drives. And
oh, mate, in the early days, it would go up to 40.
Yeah.
Like, just so there was a trainer in Australia still around that wanted to invent themselves by creating all these exuberant, exotic drives.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of it actually being factual, it was just more about attention getting.
Yeah. So I think, and this is what I teach, and it fits within a framework that serves me, is that I think that there's probably five drives that have different subsets, of course, but I think that I can fit just about everything that's going to happen within a dog's emotional range and its desires, those inherent desires. I think I can fit that within about five spaces.
Yep.
And the first being like a prey drive. And the prey drive is, you know, the dog is a predator or part thereof, right? It's an opportunistic scavenger perhaps, but there's an element of predation within dogs, of course. And that has a predatory chase sequence, which is to kill or to chase, kill, capture, eat, right? And that's a really important part of all predators have a prey drive because they need to be able to catch their food, right? That's why we have predators and prey animals. The predators go after the prey.
Yep.
The other one that goes in line with that we've discussed is defense drive, right? So defense is a response to a threat. That's how I define a defensive drive. And that defense is where the dog says, hey, like I feel threatened. I feel challenged by this and I need to respond accordingly in order to preserve my life. But it needn't necessarily be its life. It might be ownership of something. It could be a space, but it's a response to a threat. The dog has to feel threatened in one way or another in order for there to be any level of defense drive. The next one, and this one I think gets a little bit blurry because we say that dogs have like a food drive. So that's my like drive number three. But that also like the prey drive results in consumption, right? Mm. Like that's the final step in prey drive. So there's an eating element within prey. But for the most part for our pet dogs, like when we say they're predators, and remember there was that whole thing where that stupid woman was saying that dogs don't have prey drive, right? Like because they're... It's a fucking stupid thing to say, but we've cultivated it to serve us in particular ways. And you see like within the predatory chase sequence, and even that, if you look into the literature on that, oh my God, there's different versions of that. There's all these different things, but no matter, all of them result in consumption at the end, right? But for the most part, especially when we're talking about
DNA.
Yeah. But for the most part, when we're talking about tapping into prey drive, really what we're meaning is that the dog chases something that moves, right? Because that's what that's in one level or another, that's what prey drive usually solicits, is that there's movement and chasing.
Yep.
Now there's many variants.
Odor, even odor, and there's chasing.
Yeah, there's something
that- The desire to want to go after something.
Yeah, like something that acts as a draw towards, right?
Absolutely.
And very often that can end in consumption. And with some, like we see it with some dogs when we do play type prey work. Now, this can range from playing tug with your cavoodle all the way up to full-blown bite work with your Malinois, is that some dogs, when they win the equipment, go to ground with it and start tearing it apart, right? And that's the dissect before the consume. That's like ripping the guts out of the animal before you eat it. For some dogs, that consumption part is really heavily tied to prey. They need to do that. And when we see it in the bite work, like that often can result in thrashy grips and that kind of stuff because they're trying to get the kill is just a step to get towards the consumption. But what it always ends up in is dogs that fuck up equipment, right? Like it's a dog that when you're playing with the ball, when you win the ball, he runs off, goes to ground and starts shredding it, like ripping it to pieces. That's because that dog is trying to finish the predatory chase sequence and get to consume. So while there is food drive, that's an inherent hunger that can be separated from prey. A dog doesn't need to have prey drive to also have food drive. So I do think that it's worth separating those two, right? So now we've got three drives. The next one that I think is important is like a pack drive. Dogs are for the most part social animals. And I think that there's degrees to this. Some dogs really enjoy the company of other dogs, the company of other people. Some dogs don't. And there's levels to that. And just like some dogs have different elements of prey drive, different dogs have different elements of that pack drive. Like some dogs enjoy really being around people. Some dogs don't. My dog's a funny example of that. He has like a very low pack drive to strangers or to people in general. As we've talked about many times, my dog isn't traditionally social. He doesn't enjoy the company of people. He doesn't want to be pat by people. He's not aggressive to people really at all, but people he knows he'll want to interact with, but he doesn't solicit attention from anybody else in any way, shape or form. And then there's the play drive, right? Which is the innate desire, because we're talking innate, it's a drive, to be playful and to tick those boxes of the engagement through play. Now that might be with other dogs, that might be with itself. Dogs can play by themselves. They can chase shadows around and stuff like that. Although again, you're tipping into prey and I'll explain that in a moment. The thing with play drive is that it can encompass all of those drives. And the way that I like to think of it, this is actually a whole module on my course that I'm making at the moment, is that all those drives, those inherent desires of the dog, they're ways that we can manipulate the dog because they're inherent. They're going to happen, right? Most dogs, I think, distilling it down to just those five really ends up with most dogs being able to be put into one of those categories. Now, when you go through the things, you'll hear people talk about hunt drive and there's other drives that we can put into there. But usually, for sure, there's dogs that have a really high level of hunt drive and we could call it a drive in and of itself. I don't think that that's something that is as broadly across dogs as a whole. Not all dogs are going to have that. Now, certain dogs, like certain breeds, are going to have a high level of hunt. And if we're going to do detection or something like that, then that's one of the key attributes that we want to go looking for. But I don't assign that necessarily its own category. So for me, I think that there's prey, which is an appetitive response to want to chase, kill, catch, consume, right? Mm. Then there's defense, which is a response to a threat. I don't want to be killed by something, or I don't want something stolen from me, or I want to take possession over this. All the different things that a dog might perceive as a threat and respond accordingly. That's your defense drive. There's our food drive. The dog wants to eat if it's alive to this point in its life, wanted to eat. We've got our social drive, which is means it wants to spend time with other animals. They're inherently social animals. Now, there's degrees to that, of course, people, dogs, that sort of things. And then there's play. Tapping into those drives, those four first drives, can have a level of risk associated with it, right? Especially tapping into defense directly.
Mm.
And as a podcast where we're going to talk to a broad audience, and we've already talked to, well, yeah, of course, in defense with bite work dogs, of course we're tapping into defense. We must, of course. You absolutely have to.
Well, a certain type of bite work dog.
Yeah, but even still, I think that certainly for me, I'm not great at doing defense type work. Defense is not where I want to start with a dog. I want a dog to start in prey. But as my early mentors told me, prey should bring a dog into the fight, but defense will keep it there, right? Mm. Like, because predators don't lose to their prey. So that's what you see, like that level of, like when you see the predator kick up a notch and go like, oh shit, this is going bad for me. Like I'm potentially going to lose this meal, or this meal's trying to turn back on me. That switching of like kicking it up a notch is an element of defense within the prey. And that's why, you know, in the bite work, that's what we do. We do a lot of that drive shifting.
Can I make this relatable?
Mm-hmm.
The way that I like to scale this up for people who are listening at home, now that I have breached that whole defense and predatory switching of drives, if you ever go and watch kids' martial arts, generally you watch just kids fucking around in the hall. They're doing a bit of form. They're running around. They're playing games. They're like playing catch the flag. And it's basically like a bit of keepings off. Their sparring is very non-serious. Like their sparring is just like a little bit of wrestling and lots of noises and people feeling good about themselves. Anytime you watch kids doing martial arts, the minute you hit a kid, it's literally all over for the child.
Mm.
And it's the same thing in dog training as well. Like working with defense drive with dogs, A, it's not for inexperience, and B, it's not for young dogs. Of course, you want to bring dogs into the play prey side of things to start with. You want that dog to build a foundation of confidence and develop the dog in a realm where the dog thinks, hey, this is awesome. Like coming out here and getting to bite these bits of equipment is absolutely fantastic. But that's, as I said, this is where the pre-macking side comes into it. Like you teach the dog all that and you said, oh, that's been your life up until now, but now it's not.
Mm.
So now that I can see that you have a gradient of maturity, okay, you've developed along a scale. I can see that you've built some resilience and some toughness along the way. Now I'm going to add a pinch of defense into there.
Mm.
And then you add it and then you reward the dog immediately. This is not something that we just take puppies and start building defense in. I mean, I've seen people do that and usually it's a disaster. It ruins good dogs very quickly. And it's the same thing, like I said before, you know, like taking young children and punching them in the face when you're doing martial arts isn't the way to build a successful business or develop confident children. What you do is you take them and then you lightly expose it to them and then you layer it and layer it and layer it. So by the time they're becoming adolescents, teenagers and so forth, they go, I can take this. Like having this pressure in my life isn't so bad. And then it gets subsequently harder and harder into high teens adulthood. By that time, they're thinking, yep, this is part of my life.
Yeah.
I've developed an assurance that this is all going to be okay. Even though it's uncomfortable, I consent to this and I want to do it. It's part of my life.
Yeah. Your analogy is perfect. I'm about to sort of dive into that a little bit, but it is the preparation of the young dog or the kid to learn like, hey, you can kick it up a notch, you know, like if someone threatens you.
When they say I'm ready. Yeah.
But if someone threatens you, you can kick it up a notch and you can show a response to that threat. That's what defense drive is, a response to a threat, and you can potentially neutralize that threat. Right. And now, for people listening, you know, in the bite work, people are like, yeah, no shit, dickhead. But for the average pet dog owner, it's like, well, I would never do that. It's like, well, perhaps you should, right?
Yeah.
Because now how would you do it? So as I said, those four types of drives with the fifth as play, in response to the question that we're asked about different types of play drive, well, there isn't necessarily different types of play drives. There's access points to those other drives through play. So when we talk about prey drive, true prey drive is when your dog chases a rabbit. That's true prey drive. But when you've got a flirt pole and you're flinging it around, you are using Prey Drive in order to play with your dog, right? So you are using like the play.
It's mashing two worlds together.
Yeah, you're using play as an access point to get into there.
Yeah.
And so then when you're playing tug with your dog and you bring that dog, you know, you maybe sort of like use some spatial pressure over the top of it, or when you're within the environment that you're in, maybe you kick something on the floor or something like that. All the things that would normally sort of startle or scare the dog and would, you know, cause an issue, maybe the dog comes off the toy or whatever it is like that. When you build that very moderately and like expose the dog to these things, a little bit of pressure over the top, the dog meets the pressure and then you yield to the pressure. In the game, you are teaching the dog in that moment how to respond to a threat. Mm. And you respond to the threat with a forward power, right? And they do that in play, where the dog needn't ever actually feel as though it was threatened. In the bite work, we do this with puppies, where they have a sleeve or whatever that they've won. When they drop it, we challenge them for the sleeve. So you'll see, this is one of the issues, I think, with people who watch bite work and don't necessarily have the commentary as to what's happening. They're just watching somebody do it. Like, you could watch me, and at a particular angle, if you were behind me and the puppy, you're looking in the front of the puppy and you can only see my back, there's a sleeve between us. What looks like me putting a lot of pressure on that puppy and really sort of going forward with intent, I've got my hand out, I'm like trying to put pressure forward, it could look like, and you'd think, oh, Pat's really putting pressure on that puppy. I'm not at all. All of that pressure is towards the sleeve that is on the ground. And what I'm doing is challenging that puppy, saying like, hey, I'm going to steal your thing. I'm no threat to you, because what I don't want to do to a 12-week, 16-week puppy is like, I'm going to hurt you. That's the last thing I want that puppy to
do. I just
want
you to fight for it.
I want you to think I'm going to take your thing. And if you want to show me some ownership over that, you're going to have to respond to this threat. And it barks and pushes me away and I'm impressed and I let it win it in a playful way, where I still have to be the one that picks up. I still have to pick up that sleeve and still bring it to it. But what I'm doing is inoculating that dog's to threats, because I'm showing it that with this initial little small threat that you feel makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable, you feel like you're going to have a loss of your item. Not that you're in any danger yourself, but the loss of your item could happen. When you come forward and respond to that threat, you can be successful. And by showing them that they can respond to threats at a young age and that they are successful in doing that, it's one of those things that then people go, well, aren't you making that dog aggressive? And you go, well, no, this is the same as the kid going to his boxing class. This is the same as the kid going to karate and learning how to handle himself in a fight. The truth is that makes him much less likely to be in a fight as he grows up.
Teaching him to be in control.
Yeah, you're teaching him how to manage those internal states of arousal, but also know that if things go really bad, well, I can take care of this. So what it does is it reduces the hair trigger that that dog might be on. Lots of pet dogs are on a really hair trigger, because every time they've ever felt threatened, they've thought, oh, this is real, right? Yep. Like, this is a real threat towards me.
Yeah, they don't know how to manage it.
They've never been in a situation where they're in a game and the game has gotten to the point where they're like, shit, I might lose this game.
Do you know the problem there? They don't know how to end it. That's the issue, is they don't know how to end it. And that's what we teach dogs how to do. We teach dogs how to have an end to that. That's where the calfing.
Well, that's the drive shifting and the calfing, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what I mean, is that the access point to a defense drive is best done initially with a young dog, and certainly with a pet dog, is through play, where I'll be like, hey, this is getting uncomfortable for you, but kick it up a notch. Show me your response to this threat and the threat will go away. And when the dog knows how to turn off the threat, it's willing to accept a lot more threats before it acts. Mm. Because it's when a dog is like really concerned and thinks this is a real threat and I'm going to be in danger of myself, I need to act really fast, right? We see this with people. We see it, you know, with all animals, is when you think like this is an actual I'm in danger, you need to react quickly because the threat is real and existent and you need to protect yourself. But when you've learned to identify, well, this is really nothing at this point and I can wait much longer before any sort of action needs to happen. That's why dogs who are cultivating this will take a lot more pressure to bring out that response later on. Food drive. We always say it, that if a dog's alive, it has food drive. We've all been in someone's home or we've been at an event or something and someone brings out their 7-year-old obese Labrador and says it's got no food drive, right? He won't work for treats. He's got no food drive. It's like, well, he's alive. He's just never been hungry.
He's just living off 3 years of fat
fat storage. That was me before I got sick.
Can we work with food drive within play? Of course we can. We see people playing with food all the time. Mm. Because when you're training with food drive, that's where you're going to go, click, here is food, come and take it. Right. And it's that really transactional delivery of food. Now, does it work? Of course it does. We get the dog that's hungry. And if you're going to go in that model of where you're going to train with only hungry dogs, of course you can do that. Mm. But by using play as an access point to food drive, then you can make a dog eat that has no interest in eating. And we've all probably done that at some point where you get a dog really into the idea of chasing the food or pushing to get the food, or, you know, like when you make it difficult for the dog to follow a lure and they really chase the lure. And then you get dogs that eat, like, you give them the food, they get it into their mouth and they just kind of fall out because, like, oh, I didn't actually want this. Mm. Like, I don't actually want this food. It's the play that I wanted to, the pursuit of. That was what I was enjoying along the way. Our social drive. Now, of course, there's dogs that we, like we say, that just want to be around people, right? But we play with social drive and we use that quite a lot to cultivate whether we want a dog to come into our space, whether to push the dog out of our space. And we use social drive a lot in training. I use social drive way more lately than I do a lot of other things by giving and taking away my relationship with a dog during the session. Mm. And during the session, I wear a lot of different masks. It's one of the things I was talking about just this morning on a webinar where one of the things we constantly find ourselves saying in dog training is like, don't train emotionally. Don't let the dog see these emotions. But that's totally wrong, right? What we mean is don't have real emotions that you can't completely control during the session. Don't train angry. If you're emotional from something else outside of that session, don't bring the emotions into that session.
If I think about that and I think on it, it's more about lingering emotions.
Yes.
Like not being, as you said before, not being able to control yourself. Like one of the things, and I wanted to add this into a part of the conversation that you were having before, is the older I've gotten and the more I've been involved in this, the more I've listened to other people talking on topics of how to manage behavior, how to get the best of behaviors, the more I'm convinced, and this is why I've talked on it in the past called the illusion of control, I'm convinced one of the best pillars that a good educator has in any field that they have is getting their student to be convinced it was their idea.
100%.
So if you can funnel it in, like we were talking about before, like if you can get that young child in martial arts or this young puppy that's about to embark on how to implement a little bit of defense into this work, getting them to think, oh, this is my idea. I'm the one who's empowered. This came from me. When I see that in any students, I layer this in just in general work with people as well, is if I want my way in something, I find out, how do I convince the person? You're brilliant at this when you want to get something. Like when I was talking about this before, like if you have an idea of where do you want something, you'll start layering in like weeks in advance. But I'm onto your Jedi mind tricks. Because it's not only you're doing this, but I'm thinking about doing that as well. Like yeah. I'm thinking to myself, how do I reduce the resistance in this by getting you to think it's your idea so we can have a win-win moment out of this where I don't have to impose it on you, get the immediate resistance, and then you're thinking, maybe we'll compromise or anything like that. Whereas if I can just spend a little time building it up and then eventually you go, hey, I've got this great idea. And then you come up with the exact idea that I wanted. I'm thinking, that's perfect. Ooh. What I did was I've built the architecture of this entire design and given it to you for you then to think, well, I'm running with this. This is my idea.
Yeah.
And because you have it as your idea, you're far more empowered and you feel much better about it. Like even the way that you want to deliver it, like you develop the passion and the sell for it. And then I've just got to sit there and go, oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
And I relate that to the old, if you're as old as I am, there was a series called Get Smart with a couple called Don Adams and Barbara, oh, I forgot her last name, Barbara White or something like that. It was Max Smart and 86 and 99. That was their agent names. And she was the brilliant one. She was a smart one in it. Even the remake with Steve Carell, 99 was always a smart one. She came up with all the best ideas. And she'd literally lay the whole plan out and then Max would go, shh, hang on, I've got this brilliant idea. And relay the entire sequence as if it was his idea. And she just turned around and go, fantastic idea, Max.
Yep.
And it was that convinced me it is the best way to do it for anybody that's going to attempt to resist it at any stage. Why go through the resistance stage when you can just basically go through the idea stage of it and just build it slowly and carefully and model it up so the other person then embraces it and goes, hey, that's mine.
Yeah.
As I said before, I've called it the illusion of control because you're the one that's controlling this. You're puppeteering this the entire way through. And I know people, when they hear that, they go, oh, that's not really a charitable way of conveying that. That sounds sinister and nefarious.
Well, it depends on what you're organizing.
I just know that when I've been training, whether it be a student or whether I be training a dog, that I know this is best for everybody through experience because like it serves the general populace. And then I can see that I'm not doing this because I just want my way. I'm just doing this because I know this will bring on group harmony when I do it this way. But all I have to do is be patient. If I can express a gift for any up-and-coming trainers, anybody who wants to get involved with this, even people who are handling their dogs, is patience is one of the key fundamentals, one of the pillars of success in becoming a brilliant deliverer.
Mm. We were discussing this the other day, but I'll explain it again. So my youngest son, Axel, is incredible inherent skill in behavioral manipulation.
Yep.
And he has, it's innate. It's just part of who he is.
It's part of his father's genetics that have been passed on to his son.
Well, this is the thing. So both my kids, Rip looks like me, but he acts like his mum.
Yep.
And Axel looks more like his mum, but acts much more like me.
Yep.
And ever since he's 6 months old, he's sitting in the high chair eating food. The dogs are underneath him. They want the food. I have video of this. I think I've shown it to plenty of people, but he has an incredible skill of being able to sort of push the limit of persistence, I suppose is the word, right? So I have a video of him with, it's a piece of watermelon and he's sitting in a chair and he's trying to offer it to Remy. Remy wants it, right? And he's offering it to him and he pulls his hand away. And the dog, you know, is moderating himself. He's a good dog. He knows how to keep himself under control. And, you know, he knows the rules around babies and kids. And also he's in the house. So he's not displaying a bunch of drive, but he wants this watermelon. And he keeps sort of stretching out his neck and opening his mouth to take it. And Axel's teasing him by like pulling it away. And I was watching really closely because, you know, like dogs and kids, I'm always, even though I trust them both, I don't really trust either of them, right? So I'm constantly watching. And what he did was he dragged that dog's persistence to the limit. Mm. Like I could see the dog was about a second, a microsecond away from being like, oh, fuck this. He's not going to give me the watermelon and leaving. And he drags him out right to that point and then gives him the watermelon.
Wow.
Right? He could really tell like this dog's at his limit of what he's going to take. Now he does the same shit to me. He pushes me to the limit of tolerance and then comes and gives me a hug and like completely recovers me and resets everything, keeps me at this variable schedule reinforcement. But the cookie one was the funniest. So like one night we're all sitting around, he decides he wants a cookie and it's late. We've already done the dinner and everything. He knows there's zero chance. If he asks for a cookie at this point, he's not getting a cookie. Right?
Yep.
But he says to his brother, and he can barely talk at this point, right? He just looks at him, he looks at Rip and goes, cookie, right? And gets Rip fully into the idea of having a cookie. And then the pair of them come like dancing over to me, just sort of doing this little cookie dance. This two-year-old, he probably wasn't even two at this point, rallies the whole house to the point where like a Congo line, we're marching over to the cupboard and I'm handing cookies out to everyone, right? Because he wanted one. He knew there's no way. If I ask for a cookie at this point, zero chance. But if I can rally everyone behind the idea of getting a cookie and I can bring the group to want a cookie, there's a very good chance I'm going to get a cookie. And he did it incredibly to the point where I'm eating a cookie and I'm like, what the fuck just happened? Like, how did I get hoodwinked by this baby?
Which is exactly what I was talking about before, but it's incredible that a child under two could architect that.
So I think that that's an innate thing that he just has the capacity to do. He's been really, he's very good at reading people and animals and stuff like that. And it's innate. He didn't learn it. I'm not anywhere near as good as him. And it's something that he couldn't have been taught. He couldn't even fucking talk at the point where he's like leading the dog on to the limit. But anyway, all of that in relation to what we're talking about is that pack drive of like that cohesion, bringing that level of cohesion. And you can do that through play. That's one of the ways that you can do that. And it's one of the things that when I'm playing with a dog, when we talk about using pack drive, like, yes, there's an element of the dog just wanting to be around us, but there's this element of wanting to please as well. Now that can trigger some emotions in some people. Some people don't say, well, you know, dogs don't necessarily want to please anybody. They want to please themselves. But I think there's an element that most dogs, that's an element of what domestication is. Like we have over tens of thousands of years, is turn dogs into our prank monkeys that we enjoy having around because they please us. Now, whether it's that they actually truly want to please us or whether it's that we have built that the dog is pleasing itself via pleasing us, that's a different conversation. It doesn't matter. The outcome is the same.
Well, it'd be good to have Dr. Melanie Uda back on the show one day to ask her some of these questions. I did say at the conclusion of her being on the show that some of these questions would be great to throw at her from a neurobiology outcome and have her answer that, because I'm intrigued by those sort of things as well. Like, I literally was raised in those dark ages of dog training that dogs only see in black and white and, you know, like they have no souls and they do things completely for themselves and so forth. But years of knowledge, science, development and your own observations, I'm convinced that a lot of the things, like I know for a fact that some of the things that I was told were absolute wives' tales. I'm convinced that others aren't accurate. They aren't accurate to the level of what I've been told. Even some more modern day things that I don't believe are really peer reviewed, but are a popular opinion. I believe that some of those things are suffering.
Like what? Give us an example.
The one that you just said before, that dogs only do things to please themselves. Yeah. I think that fundamentally, we're all somewhat selfish. I use this observation that I see people on social media where they're giving homeless people food and money and so forth, but they're filming themselves doing it rather than having anonymous benevolence where they're just giving people things that they need because they need them, which people do. Like there are people that operate like that. But there is a horrendous amount of people, more so recently, that realize that that can be used as clout. They figure that people will look at me or look upon me like I'm a good person doing those sort of things. However, I do believe that in order to please oneself, sometimes that really comes through the pleasure of others as well. Exactly. And I think that that is very symbiotic.
Exactly.
And I've seen it in dogs where I think I know that you want pleasure, but I also know that you want to give pleasure in order to feel pleasure at the same time. So I don't believe it's as simplified as what I was told it always was.
Yeah.
It was very much dumbed down to the fact that I think that it wasn't expressed or explained in a way that was accurate. It was explained and expressed in a way that felt good enough for the person who was telling me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, yes, dogs are just minute to minute, day to day, trying to better their own situation. But I also believe that many dogs find true enjoyment in the happiness of the people that they're around.
Well, you've got to, right?
Yeah,
like in order for your environment to feel good, those around you need to be in a good state of mind as well.
Yeah.
Like that's why I'm saying, without getting too ethereal on it, understanding how symbiosis works, it's unlikely that you will be happy in an environment that doesn't conjure a feeling of happiness. Like if you go into an environment that's, you can be a very positive person, you know yourself, and I generally regard you as being quite a positive person, but you and I have been involved in certain things before where we've been in environments where we've started off happy and we haven't felt happy towards the end of the day because you can just feel that the energy has been sucked out of the air. Whereas if you role reverse that, and I often relate, one of my best mates, a guy called Ron, who I've known since I've been 16 years of age, that man can make me feel happy even when I'm in my darkest state of mind because he just radiates energy all the time. Like he's a very unique human being, unlike many other people that I've known. That Ron, he's kind of like a Robin Williams sort of character without the depressive side to him that was unfortunate.
Swings.
Yeah, that swing. But Ron can just say the most remarkable, obtuse things that you just think, that is the funniest shit I've ever heard in my life. And he can swing you around. But Ron does it for a laugh and he does it because he enjoys the group laughing together. I don't believe he does it because he's a selfish person. I believe he does it because he loves the feeling of seeing everyone happy and seeing everybody in that state of mind. The reason I know that is because I asked him, you know, like I said, how can you be this happy all the time? Do you think it's mental illness or do you think it's, he goes, no, I love the feeling of it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be like certain family members that I've got that are miserable and always finding something to be upset about. Like it just pisses me off that they always look to find the cloud in the silver lining. He said, my time in my life is much better spent
by enjoying it and feeling happiness.
Yeah, it wouldn't come as a surprise. No secret to people that listen to the show. Like, I, over the last 5 years or more, have done like a lot of work on myself. Mm. And I think one of the main things that has helped me a lot and was quite a foreign concept to me, especially from a former self, like my army version of myself, was being able to actually truly take enjoyment in the happiness of others, really truly being able to do that. And I think having kids certainly was a cultivator towards that, because it's a thing that you often say like, oh, I care about other people and blah, blah, blah. But having kids for me became, oh, I actually really do care about the well-being of somebody else more than myself. Like, really, truly, like, I care about your experience over my experience in a way that I've never felt like that about any other person.
Even right? being married, even having a
wife? Yeah, yeah, because you do. But like, at the end of the day, there's a lot of backstory in other people that you're not responsible
for. And you didn't create Jane either.
Exactly. Like, that's the
Jane
thing.
Jane is not.
That's the thing. So that's what people, that's certainly been my experience. And that's what, you know, you hear it and you don't understand it until you're in that position where you're like, oh, like, I'm totally responsible for you. Like, you're 50% my genetics. Like, I brought you into existence, but also I can't blame the experiences of your childhood, because this is your fucking childhood. Like, I am creating those experiences right now for you. So there's nothing that I get to outsource. There's nothing. I don't get to be like, oh, well, that's just who you are, because I fucking made you. And, oh, well, that's an experience that happened in the past. Well, I'm fucking responsible for all of your experiences, right? So it's something that it took me a long time to really understand, but truly feel, really enjoy the happiness of others. And it's something that I've meditated on a lot. And it's something I know we've spoken about on the podcast, but it's something I try to do, especially with people who, you know, I might otherwise consider my competitors. When I see a competitor, you know, I do well, like, my business is going great. Like, I'm happy. Things are good for me, right? Like, my life is good.
Yep.
And one of the things that I like to see is when people who I would call a competitor, they're in the same space as me, we could potentially do the same work, right? Like, I, you know, maybe you might get one person to do something and I could do it equally as well. You could flip between us. And when I see them doing an opportunity that was given to them and not to me, of course, your initial instinct is to be like, hey, what the fuck? Like, that's a lost opportunity for me. Sometimes that still surfaces, but for the most part, I try really hard to be like, hey man, fuck, good for you. Like, I'm glad you're doing well, because I'm doing good too, right? And that would have been a cool opportunity for me, and maybe I could have done it as well as you did. Who knows, right? But I'm glad that you got that opportunity. It makes me happy that that's the case. And I try really hard. It's why, you know, sometimes I follow people online that I challenge myself with that. Like, I follow people online who don't really have anything to offer me. Like, that, you know, like, I'm not learning from them, that we're peers in one way or another, but I like to see what they're doing, because I like to challenge myself and see that they're doing well and make sure that I feel good about them doing well. And I use that as a litmus test for myself when I see people doing well, or, you know, claiming to online as much as possible. And if that makes me, you know, if I have any negative emotions about somebody doing well, that to me is a litmus test of like, oh, fuck, I'm not okay, right? Because I need to continue that work. So anyway, all that is a giant tangent to talk about that pack drive that within the dog training is a really important part of it. And making the dog, like, for the most part, I think that we've selected, trained, we've bred dogs that for the most part want to please us in one way or another. Now, I do think that that is what makes them happy, but it doesn't matter. Like, that, like, the outcome is the same. Whether dogs are these magical beings that are put on earth in order to make our lives better, I'll buy into that 100%. Or that dogs have just been selected to display the attributes that make us like having them around. You know, like, I don't care which one of those it is. The outcome is the same in that what I like to do when I'm cultivating pack drive in order to train the dog is I want to show the dog pretty early on, hey, I can wear a bunch of different masks. But what's super important is that I really am in control of putting on and taking off those masks. And I think that when people aren't, that's when it becomes an issue using pack drive in that kind of way. You can't really cultivate it. So early on in the play with a dog, I want to be like, hey, here's happy, super excited version of me. And when the dog does something and it's still experimenting with behavior and it's something that I don't want to see anymore of, all I have to do is not be happy, excited version of me. All I have to do is go still. Maybe my face just goes neutral. It technically is punishment. It's a form of negative punishment, right? Where I can then start steering behavior via like, hey, that guy went away and this very boring, unhappy guy is here. Then when the dog does something I really don't want it to do, not just the thing that like isn't the right thing, but is something I don't want it to do, a completely different character can come out and the dog gets to see him. And the moment the dog changes back, the other guy can come back. And I think it's really important that they are just masks. It's all fake, right? Mm. Now, I really do feel good when the dog does the right thing. And I want to be able to display that I don't feel good when the dog does a totally wrong thing. But I can just via my posture alone show that to the dog when I've cultivated the pack drive. So all of that, to bring that around, is our question is about controlling play as a drive and the different types of play. Well, in fact, what I think is actually the case is there's just play accessing different types of drives. So play being the access point to these inherent desires. That's what we said that these drives are. So with prey, of course, that's playing tug. That's getting the dog to chase stuff. That's those games that I'm going to play with the dog that just look like the traditional playing with the dog. But then when I put some forward pressure onto the dog, or maybe make the dog a little bit uncomfortable and the dog shows me some strength, I'm not going to hurt the dog. He knows I'm not going to hurt him. I'm just making the game more challenging. And when he drops back into second gear because he needs more power, that's going into defense drive. That's tapping into it. Mm. So those rougher, more rambunctious, hey, there's a good chance you could lose this game, that's the play accessing prey, then popping over into defense. And when the dog kicks it up another notch to me and shows me, yep, I've got that level of power, I'll meet you there. I will respond to the threat. The threat might be just a loss of the game. Then I can go back into the play. And so then again with food drive, I can play games of chasing around the food and I can solicit prey drive by making the food move. Mm. I can even use like the dissect, ripping things apart to cultivate different parts of different behaviors that I might want, you know? Mm. And then with my pack drive within the game, so I can be teaching a dog, it can be again, like all of these things can be done in the same session where I'm bouncing around and tapping into those innate desires of the dogs. Because that's what I think is important when we talk about drives, is that we say, well, they're the innate desires of the dog. So they're there. There's no getting rid of them. They're there, right? You can suppress them and you can cultivate them, but they're there. And those are how you're going to manipulate the behaviors. And just attacking your dog through the drives itself, like, you know, Valerie, when she chases birds or rabbits or whatever, that is proper prey drive. Mm. Like that is 100%. She'll see it. She'll go still and she'll try and stalk it. The moment that she thinks her cover's blown, she goes hammer and tong chasing it. Given the opportunity, she'll strike it. She'll rattle it around. She'll try and kill it. There's a little element that has Mother Nature tells her she has to come and show it to me, not just parade it, but it has to be paraded directly in front of me. Mm. And then if I were to leave her with it, she'll rip it apart and she'll begin eating it, right? Like that is pure prey drive. There's no play element to that. But that same dog, I can get the tug out, flick it around. I can pretend it's a rabbit. I can do all these things. Although that is prey drive, we're accessing that prey drive through play. Yes. And I can do that with every drive and I can do it in the same session. I can do all these sorts of things. And that's how I bring up arousal. It's how I bring down arousal. And you can go even more deep into this. I have a video. The reason I have somewhat of this rehearsed is because I've got a whole series on this that's sitting on a hard drive ready to go into a course. I have a video where I get out Remy and I show like the predatory chase sequence, in that the more of it you involve, the more arousal that comes up. So I get like a ball out and I just go like, hey, here's a ball. And he's like, oh, I like balls. That's awesome. And then I throw it and he's like, whoa, I like this. And then I put a ball on a string where I can start to fight with it. So I can throw it. He can chase it. He brings it back. Now I can fight with it and it gets bigger. And so like the more of that predatory chase sequence that I involve in it, the more the arousal level comes up. So through understanding the play as an access point to all the other drives, you can then start to control arousal up, down. You can do whatever you want with this stuff. And this is dog training. Like this is the very core of how you manipulate a dog into doing things, is through those innate desires.
Interesting. And it always makes me have a little giggle, the Greyhound video where it was manufactured and convenient. And they were just thinking, well, this is the close enough thing to it. Let's chase after this false rabbit coming down the field until the real rabbit ran in front of them. They all struck right and tore off the field.
Off they go.
I often think about that in the way that we manufacture drives. And when we do it right, we're very successful in doing it. Like we can teach dogs like this is the very best thing that could be in your world. i.e. an IGP dog, a PSA dog, a Mondio dog, a
Belgian ring dog, whatever, any of those type of dogs. None of those dogs would really think, like, if there's a decoy versus a rabbit, I'm going to chase the rabbit. It would be highly, highly unlikely that that situation would arise. Certainly in my experience, I mean, I've even been on the field where other dogs have run through or real prey has run through and I've thought, oh, fuck that. That's not nowhere near much as fun as the decoy is. But in that situation, that inspired me to think a little differently when I saw that. Like, I thought to myself, interesting that all of these greyhounds were hot in the pursuit of the chase of that decoy rabbit until the real rabbit came on the field and they all just sprung off the field.
Yeah. We've discussed that. Like, I'm genuinely curious about
what happened next.
But also, is it because it was real or is it because of the angle it was moving at? You know, like, I feel pretty confidently if
that it changed.
Yeah. I feel like if you got just the average dog that wasn't trained to do differently, say it was a bite work dog and you had a fleeing decoy, and as it was chasing that fleeing decoy, that is, you know, 10 meters ahead of it, if another decoy came out and went oblique to it between them, I think it had switched to the one going oblique. Now you'd have to train it not to do that, right? Like, to go, you were told to bite that one, do it. So, like, my dog hopefully wouldn't do that because he'd been trained otherwise. So I can't really test it. But that's my feels about why they went after that rabbit, not because it was real. I could be totally wrong. Like, I'm just making assumptions, but not because it was real, but because it was new. It was like a novel thing that came out of nowhere, and that probably restarted the chase sequence.
Wouldn't you love to actually ask the dog? I mean, imagine having that capability. I know that's so left of field, but imagine having that capability of being able to really, truly have that conversation with the dog and ask that very question. Like, did you do it just because it was novel, it was different?
Or did you do it because
the odor of a real rabbit got in your nose as you're pelting down the field?
I think about this all the time. That meme gets around of, like, if you could talk to your dog for 3 minutes or 30 seconds or whatever, what would you say? And I would just say, hey, man, describe your world to me.
Exactly.
Just tell me how
like
you...
Like, what's it like living amongst us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just describe it to me. Because, like, I can communicate with my dog to the level that I need to. I don't need him to understand me any better than I do. I want to hear his point of view on things. I don't need to say, you know, like, the answers are always that I love you and the medicine is I'm trying to help you when I'm doing this kind of stuff. I know how to explain that to a dog. But what I want to know is, like, just explain how you perceive the world to me.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of assumptions. I've done a lot of research in the color spectrums that you can see in. I think that your nose is probably more important to you than your eyes. I think that you store your memories as sense rather than like visual pictures. I think that you're heavily influenced by sequencing. You know, like, I have these ideas because there's things that I can test. I can see how you react to certain stimuli, but I'm super curious, like, how do you see all of this? Just like, what colors do you see?
Speaking of that meme, it reminds me of the meme where there's a girl and a guy in bed together and they're both facing different directions.
Yeah,
and the girl's
thinking about his motorbike.
Right. Yeah. The original meme was she was going off on all these tangents thinking, you know, he doesn't love me. I'm sure he thinks I'm overweight or he's not into me. He's cheating on me. And the guy's thinking, fuck, they just released the new Ducati or something like that. And it was in complete contrast to what the other person was thinking. And I'm pretty sure, thinking on what you were just talking about before, when dogs are doing, acting and thinking about things, I believe that we've got to a pretty profound position where we're in parallel to a lot of the ways that they're doing and thinking about things. But you can never truly be sure because in a lot of ways we would like to imagine that. Now, it's very convenient for a dog in order to survive and live in our world. Like, they're kind of thinking, well, I have to go along with this. What this giant bear is doing with me, I have to go along with this in order to survive to make sure he puts food in my bowl. I'm sure they're not articulating it to anywhere that level of degree, but they understand this is my world and this is what I've got to do. But how do they think and feel about it?
Yeah.
We've talked about that importance about the aspect of life in general is how do you think and feel about things?
The sort of example I really regularly come back to, and you would see it here all the time, and you see it especially in those videos, you know, where someone's been like, it's a soldier getting home and their dog hasn't seen them in a year or something like that. The initial meeting is always really awkward because the dog doesn't do shit. And in fact, sometimes the dogs bark at them and then there's this moment where the dog just clicks and suddenly recognizes them and
it's the odor.
And so, like, very clearly the dog remembers you as a scent picture, yep. not a sight picture.
Right.
Whereas, like, for me, if I haven't seen you in 2 weeks and someone says, hey, you know, Glenn, I got a picture of you in my head. I can see you, right? Clearly not for a dog.
Well, you can't say that to a dog. You can't say.
No, that's it.
Hey, right? Do you remember your daddy?
Yeah. But so what's wild is like when they see you, they're like, I don't know who the fuck you are. Mm. Like, I don't recognize you in any way, shape or form. Why are you so forward with me? Like, why are you acting like we know each other? And it's not until they're into the scent cone and then they go, oh, wait, I know exactly who you are. And so when a dog thinks of a person, first of all, do they think of a person, right? In your absence, we've discussed this, like, do they ruminate on you in any way, shape or form? And what is it that they're reminded of? Like, how do they think of you when they think of you? You know, like my dog, he's like all highly trained dogs. He doesn't do well without me. If I'm gone for 36 hours or whatever in the home, he really doesn't have a sense of self without me in the home. And so Jane sends me photos of him all the time, just sitting staring at the door. Like, he's just waiting for me to get home.
Mm.
So he obviously misses me, right? There's an element of it's uncomfortable without me there. Right. Valerie doesn't give a shit. She lives her life like nothing's happened. Right.
Does he miss you or does he miss what you do for
him? I don't know. Right. That's like, this is the thing. There's no way to know.
Like to ask those questions.
Yeah. So when he's sitting there staring at the door, that he'll do once it's like, once that 36 hour period clocks over, that's pretty much all he does is he just stares at the door like, fuck, he has to come back soon or else like things get really bad for me. What's he thinking? Like, what's going through his mind?
Love to know.
No way to know, right? Mm. And so that's what I want to ask when I get my 30 seconds to talk to the dog and be like, hey, just describe how things go down for you.
Well, now that I've got my 3D printer, I'm going to invent something.
If only. All right. I reckon that's the place to wrap it up.
That is the place to wrap it up.
Hey, that's it. Another episode. Kind of paradigm.
Mm.
We did it.
We did it. Hardly coughed.
We tried our best. Yeah. I sound a bit nasally.
Yeah.
I had to record something during the week, like as part of this like sales video, and the main thing is done, but then I had to change a small part of it. And it took me like an hour to try and get myself to sound like I sounded when I recorded the first part. In the end, I gave up. I was like, oh, who cares? You can just tell that I'm sick. Yeah. It was, anyway, that's my life.
Yeah.
Anyway, hey, you should probably rate the show if you're listening.
Do that.
You should probably just get into iTunes or...
If you haven't done it, I think what you need to do is grab a chair, go and find a mirror, sit in front of it, have a good hard look at yourself and say, why haven't I rated the Canine Paradigm on one of the social media platforms?
Yeah.
Why?
It's a whole thing.
Why didn't I?
I know it's a pain in the ass. No one wants to do it, but it's a thing. It helps us. It helps people see and go like, oh, yeah, I'll give that a listen. Someone else gave it 5 stars. I'll check it out. And then they're bam, we got them.
I did it the other day. I stayed at a place in Canberra. They sent me a thing, said, hey, did you like our stay? And I thought, I did. I did like my stay.
It was wonderful.
The room was lovely. It was nice and clean. They were very helpful with everything I asked. So I gave them a 5-star review.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. Well,
I do that for all my Uber drivers. Uber makes it really easy though.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Uber just goes, hey, what did you think? You know, how would you rate it? It's very easy. You just tap and then they go, how would you compliment the driver?
Have you ever given a really bad rating?
I haven't had an Uber driver that's been shit.
Yeah, so I gave a 1-star review on Uber once because it was the guy was like, I thought he was drunk. It was really, I was like, hey man, pull over. We're fucking done here.
Yeah.
And they called me straight away. Within half an hour, the phone rang.
That's
and,
good.
Yeah, phone rang. We're like, hey, what happened?
Yeah.
And I told them and they were like, oh, sweet. Reimburse me the whole lot.
Yep.
So anyway, there you go. Yep, that's my Uber story.
All right. From now on, anywhere I go, I'll give 1-star reviews.
All right. So give us a review.
Yeah. Not 1-star.
No.
Like you won't get any money back.
If you want to support the show, you can do that via Patreon.
Mm.
I've got plenty of stuff in there, more stuff going in there.
Yep.
I do a live stream when I'm not dying. So, and I've got to make up that one. I've got all the questions. I'm going to record it and just put it straight.
I tell you, I am getting some heat over the, I promised that I was going to do one and you and I did say we're going to do it together on judging for PDC and PSA 1.
Well, why don't we do that with Janet when she's here?
That would be great because I literally have been getting death threats over it.
Yeah. Well, without her consent, let's say right now that we'll record something.
Even without Janet, we still need to do it.
Okay.
Like at some stage, we still need to make that happen because even people who aren't doing PSA have said to me, hey man, you promised you were going to do it.
Mm.
Like Pat's doing all the heavy lifting in Patreon. You're literally doing nothing. So I got called out for it. And I said, look, fair call, fair call. That is true. That is true. And you've got me. So
we'll record something. Let's do it.
Yep.
All right. So get into Patreon. Another way you could support us is buy some merch.
Yes.
Why not? You got to wear clothes. May as well have our logo on it.
Finn McCabe does.
Yeah.
He wore it to Crofts.
Yeah. He wore it to Crofts and he also can't wait to show it off to everybody and take pictures with people wearing his TCP gear.
Yeah, love it.
There's tons of people. There was a person that sent me a clip on the other day, which I put it up. Every time people send it to me and tag me in the Canine Paradigm, I always put it in our little 24-hour reel just to say, hey, I see you, I appreciate you, and thanks for buying our merch. It looks cool.
There you go.
All right. The last thing is if you want to get in contact with us, you can jump in the Facebook discussion group. That's where a bunch of info can be group sourced, that kind of stuff. We're always looking in there, keeping an eye on what we can talk about on the show. If you've got topic ideas, get it into there.
We've had a suggestion on that too recently, which I just remembered, is that a few people would like us to do one of those, what do we used to ask us questions, whatever it is?
Oh, an AMA.
Yeah.
Ask us anything.
Ask us anything. Yeah. Okay. So like a random one where we just have a bit of fun with it and
all right,
like,
well, let's do that next
you know,
week.
Like do like half a dozen questions and you and I just try and deliberate all the world's problems in one smeltering cauldron.
Let's do that next week.
Why not?
We'll do that.
Yeah.
All right. And if you want to get in contact with us directly, shoot us an email. We are info@thecanonparadigm.com. Love you. Goodbye.